For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Peter Flaherty, and Millie is asleep. What we've got here is we are down to 16 teams in the NCAA tournament coming out of regionals last weekend. We're going to get ready for super regionals this coming weekend. On this episode of the podcast, we're going to run through these eight super regional matchups, break them down as best as we can. Very exciting round of regionals, I thought, around the country. Hopefully we can get some more of that kind of energy this weekend for super regionals. I thought we did great with weather. I thought we did great with drama. There were some great performances over the weekend. It was all around. It was a very enjoyable start to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, no, it was a super exciting weekend. There were a lot of upsets, some great teams advancing. I think all in all, we've got a slate of eight really fun and entertaining super regional matchups.
Yeah, you mentioned upsets. We definitely got some of those. There's a four seed through to super regionals for the second time in 3 years, but just the eighth time in the history of super regionals, which of course date to 99. That's Oral Roberts. You know, you had a couple two seeds winning, but you know, the big upset was coming from Oral Roberts. Had a chance for a second one with Penn reaching the regional final at 2-0, but the Quakers couldn't quite get it done against Southern Miss. So Oral Roberts stands as your Cinderella. And, you know, that's a fun story coming through to super regionals. We don't usually get something like that, obviously. But what we don't have is any three seeds. That's a rarity. It was a little chalky, but with just enough upsets mixed in to keep everyone entertained, I think. And then, you know, some absolutely massive performances like Trey Richardson hitting three home runs and driving in 11 runs in a game. That was pretty special. And, you know, the game of not just the tournament for me, but probably of the year at any level of baseball, with Clemson and Tennessee going at it on Saturday night. I was fortunate to be there and see that 14 inning masterpiece. Although, frankly, Peter, I would have appreciated like maybe two or three less twists and turns the second half of that game. It was like, honestly, just, it was a little too much. At some point you reach diminishing returns with the level of twists and turns and clutch hits and big moments and everything. It was just like, okay, like this is overkill. I am a little overloaded by what's going on in this game. But I mean, for me anyway, like I cannot imagine a better game of baseball being, or more exciting game of baseball being played this year. And if there is one, I assume it would happen in October in the big leagues, and we would all be consider ourselves very lucky to have gotten to watch that game.
Yeah, no, I was going to say the 14 inning affair, it looked as if Clemson was going to be in the driver's seat in that regional up until Zane Denton's swing with two strikes in the ninth to give Tennessee the 5-4 lead. And then it's like, okay, Tennessee has all the momentum. They're going to close this out in the ninth. Then Clemson ties it. And then it's just back and forth with big play after big play, big pitch after big pitch. And then finally, Hunter Ensley comes through in the 14th with the go-ahead RBI double. But I'm with you. There was a game-saving, game-changing type of play made almost in each half inning of the extra inning duration. So that was one of the more entertaining games in recent memory. As you said, I can't imagine that anything is going to top that in terms of just sheer excitement, but you never know.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see if anything can do it. And look, I'm happy to be proven wrong that maybe there will be a better game. And like, look, that would be great. I'd enjoy seeing something like that again, because it was a really, really special game. That, I mean, it started out really fun with Grice and and Dolander, and you know, it was well played for throughout the entirety of the regulation, or through the first eight innings, and then in the ninth inning everything got goofy. It was still really well played, but that was really when things heated up, and off it went into lore, certainly in Tennessee history, but I also think that'll be remembered for a while, just in terms of best games that have been played in the regional round of the tournament.
Oh, without a doubt. I know that's one, and I've been doing it way less than you have, but coming away from that one and watching it, I'm sure you seeing it live even more so, but that's one that I'll remember probably for as long as I can recall. So special one, and this weekend should provide more of the same.
Yeah, so let's get into these super regional matchups. We can certainly look back at how the route that some of these teams took to get here, but I think everyone's at this point very excited about what is to come this weekend. So that's what we're going to get into today on the podcast. And I guess let's just start with this in chronological order. The first game up of Super Regionals will be on Friday with Duke going to Virginia. That draws the noon game, which I'm a little surprised about. I thought that maybe that would have gotten a better TV slot, but it is how we're starting the week or the weekend with Duke going to Virginia. Now, these two teams played each other during the regular season in Charlottesville, no less, and Duke won that series, and it was a really big deal when they did. It wound up, Duke wound up not hosting. But at the time, that pushed Duke into first place in the division, and it looked like maybe they could even get a top eight seed. And I think it was right after that Duke went on finals break, or no, right after that Virginia went on finals break, and Virginia bounced back after its finals break, and Duke, I don't want to say they fell apart, but all the momentum that they had built with their incredible April kind of got, it took a hit with them being off for finals. And the end result was Virginia was a top eight seed and Duke had to go on the road. No matter, though, they went to Conway. They took care of Coastal. Duke pitched incredibly well this weekend, as they have much of the year, but incredibly well. Virginia, meanwhile, swept through their regional. They took care of East Carolina in the regional final. But we've got an ACC showdown here in Charlottesville.
Yeah, and it's going to be a really, really good matchup. As you mentioned, the two teams played each other earlier on, and Duke's, I think them taking two out of three in late in April, that was kind of everyone's, okay, Duke is for real moment. And they had a tough regional in Conway with Coastal, Rider, and UNCW in that pod. And they kind of cruised by UNCW before Rider gave them all they could handle. And credit to Rider, they beat Coastal, and they didn't go down without a fight in really throughout the regional. So they had an impressive showing, but Duke bounces back from its loss against the host Coastal to force an all important game seven on Monday night, which they were really in control from the first pitch in that one. So there was never really a doubt. Liam Doyle, who was great in his first start of the regional, wasn't as sharp, I think a byproduct of really very minimal rest. So it was a lot to ask of him. And Duke's pitching, as it has been all year, it's been the strength of the club. So I think they have the best back end of the bullpen maybe of any team remaining in the field of 16 with Fran O'Shell and James Talon. As we've touched upon, if you can get them the ball with the lead or in a tie game going into the seventh or eighth inning, Duke's usually in pretty good shape to close that one out with a win. So they looked really good. And then UVA, as you mentioned, swept their way through Charlottesville, pummeled Army in the very first game of the tournament. Actually, they won 15-1, and then they had two hard-fought victories over a quality East Carolina club. So it should be a really good one in Charlottesville. I think that it's going to be difficult to not give the edge to UVA in this one. I don't know if Duke can essentially win two series against the Wahoos in a single season, and not to mention UVA is 35-4 at home, which they're going to have as good of a home crowd as they have all year this weekend. And I think it's a bit of an uphill battle for the Blue Devils going on the road, but I think that while the ball might fly in UVA's yard, I think it's going to be a pretty pitching centric weekend. You know, we mentioned the Duke bullpen, and they have solid starters of their own. And then if you look in the UVA dugout, you have Conley Early, Brian Edgington, Jack Parker, and then a strong bullpen anchored by Jay Woolfolk and Jake Berry. So a really fun weekend on tap, I think.
Yeah, I mentioned how well Duke pitched all weekend, but Virginia really, really did it as well. They gave up 5 runs on the weekend. East Carolina got 3 in the Sunday final, but the first 2 games, Virginia just gave up 1 run apiece in those 2. They pitched at a really high level, and you know, they have done a good job of finding their guys, and Jake Berry has really come on. He did a good job at the back end of the games. They've got Woolfolk. Since they put Jack O'Connor more in the bullpen, like, that's kind of added another arm, and all 3 of those guys can go multiple innings, especially Berry and O'Connor as former starters. So they're definitely going to be able to pitch it. And, you know, Duke is out there with one of the best pitching staffs in the country this season, despite certainly the best bullpen. You know, they're kind of using openers to do it, but like they're mixing and matching, and it's been working all year, and it worked again in regionals. And I mentioned Trey Richardson hitting 3 home runs in a game. You know, we can't also forget that MJ Metz hit 3 home runs in a game on Friday against UNCW. And he had a really good weekend overall. He homered again in the Monday final. And he's doing all of this, I guess we're now 2 weeks after he tore his ACL in the ACC tournament. So, you know, we've got this year's Mike Elko, different player. This year's Tim Elko, you know, in terms of a guy putting an offense on his back on a bum knee. MJ Metz is fulfilling that role, and he's coming off of a huge weekend. You know, they can swing the bats as well, but I'm with you. I think that this is going to be a relatively pitching and defense kind of super. But if it does turn into a slugfest, I think both of these teams will be fine. You know, obviously Virginia can score runs almost at will with like Kyle Teal and Jake Geloff, but you know, Duke has the guys to keep up, especially if Metz is going to keep doing what he's been doing.
Yeah, no, and I'm with you. I think if this does turn into a slugfest, offensive centric kind of weekend, while Duke they've got the weapons to do it, but if it does end up going in that direction, it's tough to not give the edge to a lineup that boasts Kyle Teal, Jake Geloff, the Ethan Anderson and Ethan O'Donnell. It is a really deep lineup that gives opposing pitchers no break. So Duke's going to have their work cut out for them, but it should be a really well-played, tightly contested series for the entirety of the weekend.
Yeah, I do like Virginia here, like you, Peter. I think the home field advantage is significant here, but I will say that, you know, because Duke plays Virginia annually, and because it this year went to Charlottesville and won a series, it is in no way going to be scared of going down the road, intimidated by the atmosphere, none of that. Like, they're going to be ready for this. Now, where the difference, I think, might come is that while this is Duke's 3rd Super Regional in 5 seasons, none of these players really have Super Regional experience. Like, it might actually be none left from the 2019 team. Like, I'd have to go player by player, I guess, but I think it might be 0. Whereas Virginia still has players that were on the 2021 World Series team. You know, I really do think experience like that plays when you're dealing with the pressure of trying to get to Omaha. So we'll see. But I think Virginia certainly is going to feel confident going into this weekend. All right, let's move it on. The second super that will get played on Friday is Indiana State and TCU. That starts at 5. So we're going to have a little bit of a break. I kind of wish that game was starting earlier, but, you know, whatever. I didn't set the schedule. That game is going to be played. That whole series is going to be played in Fort Worth, which is not the way it should be done. TCU was the 2 seed in Fayetteville. They swept through the regional hosted by Arkansas. TCU is on an incredible hot streak right now, having finished the season really well, then won the Big 12 tournament, and now swept through a regional at Bomb Walker Stadium. But they, again, they were not a number one seed. They were two. Indiana State was a host last weekend, the number 14 overall seed in the tournament, and they swept through the Terre Haute Regional, beating Iowa in the final. However, this the Super is being played in Fort Worth because Indiana State has a scheduling conflict. They annually host the Special Olympics state event of Indiana, and that happens to be this weekend. It's a lot to ask of one campus to put on a Super and put on Special Olympics. Like, there's just only so many resources in a city like Terre Haute. And so they did not bid to host Supers. So instead, they're on the road in Fort Worth. Unfortunate circumstances for the Sycamores, who, not unprecedented. The same thing happened to Missouri State. It was in 2015. Missouri State shares their ballpark with the AA team, and the AA team was supposed to be home, and the AA team had precedent. So Missouri State's Super got moved to Fayetteville, and Arkansas won and went to Omaha. So this happens every now and again. Apparently it only happens to Missouri Valley teams lately, but that's the situation. TCU is going to be really hard to beat. They are, again, they're on this incredible hot streak. They're arguably the hottest team in the country right now. We'll get to Oral Roberts, but TCU is arguably the hottest team in the country right now. And just the way that they handled their business in Fayetteville was really, really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, when thinking about TCU and preparing for the podcast, and I was, it's them and Oral Roberts who are the two hottest teams in the United States right now. And admittedly, TCU was hot even before their outburst in Fayetteville. They had, I think they were entering the tournament winners of 11 of their last 12 or 12 of their last 13. Regardless, it was an impressive run for the Horned Frogs. And to see them go to Bomb Walker, it was a little bit of a disappointment because it was, at least in my mind, and I'm eating a big, hearty serving of crow right now. I was like, oh man, that's kind of a buzzsaw. Their season might kind of come to an end after a hard-played regional in Fayetteville. But they stormed through Arkansas. They beat them handily twice. The Monday game was closer than the final score indicates. They kind of used some late inning production to propel themselves to victory, but the Horned Frogs are a runaway train right now, and the fact that they get a home super regional on top of playing the best baseball they have all year by far is, I mean, it's a pretty big task for the Sycamores. But honestly, as we've seen with Indiana State all year, they're not scared of anyone. They won't bow down from competition, especially they won't be fazed by going on the road and facing a good team. And in reading your Fort Worth regional preview, and getting some more knowledge on the Sycamores, they're and this is it's kind of evident in just watching them play. If you sit down and watch them play, but I'm trying to figure out how to describe. They just do everything really well. They aren't going to beat themselves. It's not a really prospect-clad team. They do have Jared Spencer, Matt Jacek, on the pitching staff, who are probably their two best pro prospects. Spencer leading the way, but he's not eligible till next year. But they get production from all parts of their lineup. There isn't one guy in the lineup, kind of like a Kyle Teal with UVA, for example, that you can point to and be like, okay, he's going to lead the way for the Sycamores. It's all going to focus around him. He'll provide most of their production. They get it from they get it really from anyone in their lineup on any given day, which I think makes them dangerous. And pitching wise, I think there's no one better to set the tone than Matt Jacek. He's a really experienced guy, pounds the zone. He's got a plus slider, fastball, doesn't have premium velo, but it has good life to it. And he's going to throw quality strikes. And, you know, TCU is playing so well right now that it might not matter. They might just still pummel him. But I don't know. I think that this is going to be a really good series. I'm not quite sure who to give the edge to. I really find it hard not to give it to TCU, both after last weekend and then the fact that they get to play it at home. I mean, that's a really, really big deal for them to go from a 3 seed to now hosting a super regional. Unique circumstances, I know, but one that really plays in their favor. And if you look at their lineup, they're firing on all cylinders right now. Ben Abelt out of the bullpen is nails. He hasn't allowed an earned run in his last 18 and two thirds innings pitched. Cole Klecker, freshman on the mound, has been excellent. They get Luke Savage back. I mean, they're about as good as you can find in the country right now. So the Sycamores have their work cut out for them, but without a doubt, they're not going to roll over.
I'm going TCU, and I don't feel amazing about it because, like you, I think that this is going to be a little more competitive than some people might think on the surface. But just the way TCU is playing, like, honestly, like, I don't even care where this is being played. Like, yes, it's an advantage to be at home, but I don't think it's such a massive advantage. In TCU's case, like, they have a really good, like, they certainly feel comfortable playing in Lupton. But it's also not like going into a hornet's nest of Bomb Walker or the Box or Starkville or something. Like, it's a good home field atmosphere, but it's, again, it's just not one that's like, it's a ballpark that plays relatively normally. You know, it's not something where you like really have to like, oh, like this has a goofy setup and like they're really like geared to play here. Like, I mean, it's a relatively normal ballpark in terms of dimensions and stuff, and you know, TCU will have plenty of fans there and they'll be behind their team and they get to sleep in their own beds and everything, and all of that matters. But if you're Indiana State and you spend the first 6 weeks of the year playing on the road anyway, like, I just don't think that this specific team that TCU has coming in is going to be phased by what they have to throw at them in terms of the home field advantage. But I just think that the way TCU is playing right now, the way that offense is going, it's strength on strength. And I guess just give me, having watched TCU drop 20 on Arkansas, give me the TCU offense is where I'm going. I think TCU can pitch it fine, but you know, the big thing here is just going to be, how does the Indiana State pitching staff and their defense, because this is a pitching and defense team, how do they deal with TCU's offense, which has the ability to beat you with some power? Obviously, they've got Taylor, you know, in the heart of the lineup. He's not the only one that can run the ball out, though. And then TCU, like, Peter, this had like completely gone under the radar for me. And maybe this is, maybe I'm completely dumb for having missed this. I tried to watch as much TCU as I could during the season because they were a team that was confusing me. So I feel like I put on an awful lot of TCU games, but none of this registered until I was, you know, looking through stuff during the tournament. They have stolen like 138 bases this year, and they're stealing bases at an 85% clip. Like, it is wild. They've been thrown out 19 times in like 160 steal attempts.
So it's funny you mentioned that, because when I was digging into TCU and Indiana State today and just kind of doing my due diligence and looking through the rosters and anything that might stick out, I noticed they were 139, as you mentioned, 139 for 158. There is not a single real clogger on the base paths on the entire roster. I guess maybe Curtis Byrne is the only real non-threat to run. But other than that, I mean, you got to have your head on the swivel on the mound at all times. You'll have to hold 8 of the 9 runners on, and I mean, they're a really good base running team. It's, I think what sticks out is their base running skills, because you look at the roster and they don't have one super burner like an Enrique Bradfield. No one has an Enrique Bradfield, but they don't have
any. I mean, like, Nunez is the best, and he's what, a 6, maybe a 7?
Right, exactly. And they don't have anyone with real game breaking speed. They just all know how to run the bases. They have a really good base running system. And they're all problem causers on the bases. So, and as you mentioned, kind of reverting back to it, it's Indiana State, as they have done to every single team they've faced this season, they'll give TCU all it can handle, but it's hard to not give the edge to a team that averaged 16 runs a game against Arkansas just a week ago. And now they're really going to be feeling it at home. So, they're in a really good spot to advance to Omaha.
All right. Next up is South Carolina at Florida. Both of these teams were hosts last week. Both of them, you know, advance here. South Carolina swept through Columbia. They beat Campbell in the final. They took care of NC State in the winner's bracket game before that. Florida advances despite losing on Saturday night. They won three straight must-win games, eliminated UConn, and then beat Texas Tech twice, pitching it incredibly well along the way. Florida, the number two overall seed, is hosting the Super. It starts at 6 o'clock on Friday. It is the first of two All-SEC Supers we will talk about. And Peter, the most notable thing here for me is that South Carolina, yes, it was just one weekend, but South Carolina sure looked like the South Carolina we saw 2 months ago, much more than the South Carolina we saw 2 weeks ago. And that's great news for the Gamecocks.
Big time. And it's really ironic because I guess you could call it the turning point of their season was after a sweep of Florida at Founders Park. And that's kind of when everything went downhill with injuries and poor play and whatnot. And they were coming into the tournament really not riding any sort of momentum. They had a nice 9-0 win to open up the SEC tournament, but they then lost the next two games to LSU and Texas A&M, being outscored by a combined margin of 15-3. So they kind of limped into a hosting spot. I think being rewarded, or I don't know if rewarded is the word to use, but earning a host, I think, was a big sigh of relief for them. They play really well at Founders Park. It's an offensive-centric ballpark. It plays really well into the strength of the South Carolina team. And they didn't get an easy draw by any stretch of the imagination. They got Campbell, who, for my money's worth, they're the best mid-major in the country, just year in and year out. And then they get NC State, who's never an easy matchup. And then a Central Connecticut State team that ran through the NEC and has a couple of good arms. So going into the weekend, we each had pegged them as favorites to be upset. And honestly, going into the regionals, if talking about Campbell coming out of that region wasn't really all that big of an upset, I didn't think. So they had everything kind of stacked against them, but they rolled through Columbia. They looked exactly like that March and April South Carolina team that was so good. They threw the ball well. They mashed all weekend, and now they head down to Gainesville against a Florida team that they know they can play well against. They've already swept. And with all the confidence in the world. And then with Florida, they made their way through the loser's bracket to advance to their first super regional since 2018. And for as good as that Gators offense is and as much praise as it gets, the pitching staff was just unbelievable all weekend. Anywhere you looked, every arm was contributing quality innings on the mound. They threw the ball really well. The stuff was electric as always. So, these are two teams, as we kind of got treated to every weekend in, you know, April and May with these big time SEC series. This will be more of the same, and they're on a collision course for a really entertaining weekend.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And, you know, South Carolina is going to come in with confidence, having played really well over the weekend. And then, you know, knowing that they handled Florida earlier in the season. And I also imagine, though, that they're probably going to be able to, you know, despite having swept Florida earlier, I imagine they're going to be able to play up but we're the underdog and nobody believes in us this weekend. Like, so they're going to have like the best of both worlds. They're going to have the confidence in knowing they can beat the team that they're matched up against and also be able to say nobody believes in us. So dangerous combination right there. The other really notable thing here for South Carolina is they looked so much different offensively this weekend. And I don't want to put this all on the fact that Will McGillis was hitting leadoff, but having that guy back really for the first time in like 2 months, it made a difference in the lineup. It made a difference that Wimmer was back at shortstop for the first time in a month. And you know, they're in a really good spot with all of that. The question now is just, does that matter on the road, because South Carolina has been much more beatable away from home than they have been in Columbia this season. And then B, you know, like you said, every arm that Florida turned to this weekend, whether we're talking about, you know, Hurston Waldrop or Cade Fisher, like anyone in a big spot, they all delivered. Can South Carolina beat Florida's top arms twice in a year? You know, that's it's a big ask to have to win two series against a team like Florida to get to Omaha. And, you know, that is now the task that's facing the Gamecocks this weekend.
It's a tall one for sure. But as you've mentioned, having that South Carolina lineup back to pretty much full strength, I think gives it a lot of stability. It gives a feeling of normalcy. It kind of takes the load off of, I think, everyone else in the lineup outside of, you know, Will McGillis and Braylon Wimmer. Everyone kind of goes back to pulling their own respective load, so to speak. I think that guys are going to press a lot less. And we saw it this weekend. They played really loose. They played, they were driving the ball over the yard, and it was a balanced attack. And you look up and down the lineup, there are seven or eight guys that can really beat you. And I think a key in the bottom third of the order in looking at it is Michael Braswell. You look at the stat line and the back of the baseball card, nothing's really going to jump out, but it seems like he always comes through with a clutch hit or two every weekend. And then up at the top, obviously, it's just loaded with Petrie, Messina, and Wimmer. So that's about as good of a 2-4 hitter stretch as you can find. And while they do have their work cut out for them with Florida, it's going to be a really, really good weekend. But I think that with the Gators pitching, being at home, and, you know, they are 33-6 at home, not to mention. But I really find it hard to believe that, you know, the Gamecocks are going to be able to come out on top twice against Florida. So I think I lean Florida here.
Yeah, it's boring to keep saying that the hosts are the favorites here, but the hosts are the favorites here. And, you know, one last thing on Florida is I'll be interested to see how they set up the pitching staff. Caglione started the opener as Florida saved Brandon Sproat for that winner's bracket game. Presumably they'll go back to Sproat, though he, you know, pitching on Saturday to pitching to Friday, that's one day less rest than is typical. But Caglione then, assuming he goes back to Sunday, because Waldrop will pitch on Saturday, if it comes to that, he'll be more rested. And then how does that impact things? So, and if you look at Jack's splits, the home road is significant. So him being at, you know, in Gainesville, if it comes down to a winner take all game three, I would feel like a rested Jack Caglione pitching at home is a comfortable spot for Florida to be in.
Yeah, and not to mention, like, home road splits aside, he's only allowed more than one earned run in, I think, one of his last six appearances. So not only does he throw the ball really well at home, he's hit his stride on the mound. So you're going to get a fully rested, completely dialed in Caglione if it goes to three, which we'll see if it does, but he's throwing the ball as well as he has all season.
Meanwhile, South Carolina, a little uncertain what they'll do in a third start, if it got there. So we'll, that is something to watch. And as of now, Mark Kingston has not made any sort of announcement on the rotation. So, something to watch, as we get ready for that series to open. Last game on Friday will be Oral Roberts going to Oregon. That starts at 8 Eastern. Oral Roberts, like I mentioned earlier, is the Cinderella of the tournament. They were a number 4 seed in Stillwater. They swept through that regional. They did. they really handled their business just fine. And you can say they're underseeded and all the rest of it. And, like, look, they were. But they're still a 4 seed. And we're going to call them a Cinderella, regardless of the fact that that nobody but Wake Forest has more wins than Oral Roberts this season, and any other number of stats that indicate that Oral Roberts is a pretty good team. But I'm gonna fit them for the slipper regardless. Oregon, meanwhile, comes out of Nashville, where they were the number 2 seed. They swept through that. They took care of Xavier in the final. They beat Vanderbilt in the winner's bracket. And Oregon, you know, won the Pac-12 tournament and is also carrying a fair amount of momentum. They're not quite TCU in terms of hot, but they're not far off. And they now get to host a super regional for just the second time in program history. You got to go back to 2012. for the last time they hosted. And of course, that one did not end well for Oregon as they got upset by Kent State, which was Cinderella-ish itself. They were only a 3 seed, not a 4 seed, but and overshadowed as a Cinderella in 2012 by Stony Brook. But still, you know, it's Kent State. They're I love the MAC, but it is what it is. And so now Oregon trying to get to Omaha, and they'll have to go through Oral Roberts to do it.
Yeah, no. And like you mentioned, Oral Roberts going into that Stillwater regional, which I think was the most loaded regional in the field this year with Oklahoma State, Washington, DBU, and ORU. That's as good of a quartet as you can find. But ORU, 49-11 on the year. They haven't lost since April 22nd against North Dakota State. And they ran through Stillwater. They beat host Oklahoma 6-4 to improve to 3-0 on the year, all in Stillwater against Oklahoma State. They then won a slugfest against Washington that kind of, when I was watching, I was like, okay, so here's the Stillwater regional game of the regional, where it was a more football looking score. And they were down. They went down 8-0. Washington looked like they were going to improve to 2-0 and get into the driver's seat in that regional. But ORU, they can beat you in so many ways. And you talk about these teams that are equipped to hit with other teams and get into a pitcher's duel. And granted, some of it is a byproduct of playing at O'Braid Stadium, but they come back to win 15-12, and then they win a tight one-run game against DBU on Sunday night to sweep their way through the regional. And it was funny, you mentioned how the hosts kind of have the edge so far in discussing these. I'm all in on the Golden Eagles this weekend. I think that they're going to go to Eugene and take a series from Oregon to advance to Omaha, and they're a super well-rounded club top to bottom offensively. Jonah Cox, he has a 44-game hitting streak. He's hitting .424. And then pitching-wise, they really throw the ball well as a team with a 3.8 ERA. But a couple guys to hone in on. Kate Denton, the Summit League Pitcher of the Year. He earned a save in all 3 games last weekend. He's got a 1.6 ERA with 75 Ks, so just 9 walks and 54 innings. Fastball up to 98, that's just... it's like hitting against a bowling ball, and then a really nasty slider to supplement it. And Jacob Widener also out of the bullpen. It's a very, very unique look. 6'7" lefty, super high waisted, 74 strikeouts in 45 innings. And they have a really sound rotation as well. So I think that not only does Oregon have their work cut out for them, but I think that any team that goes against ORU does going forward. And then if you talk about the Ducks, I think underratedly, they're one of the hottest or hotter teams in the country with 9 straight wins, a Pac-12 tournament championship. And then I think almost underratedly, they swept their way through the Nashville Regional. They won a pair of one-run games to improve to 2-0 before a sound 11-2 win over Xavier on Sunday. But I kind of looked up going into Sunday and I was like, man, you know, Oregon is 2-0. They've got Xavier. Xavier would have to beat them twice. And you know, the Ducks took care of business on Sunday, and this was without Jay Stofall, whose status I know is still up in the air for this weekend. And if they can get him back, I think that would be a big time difference maker on the mound for them. And he's been their steadiest arm all year, although he hasn't pitched since late April. But I think playing at PK Park for the Ducks is obviously a big time advantage, and their lineup is really firing at all cylinders right now. Riku Nishida up at the top is outstanding, and then you have Drew Cowley and Sabine Ceballos as your 3-4 hitters, which provide most of the thump. So I think that the Ducks are going to get all that they can handle and play well in front of their home crowd. But man, I'm not going to bet against the Golden Eagles this weekend.
So I like Oregon, and I don't know that I have like a real rational explanation for that. I don't really understand how Oregon has gotten as hot as they have all of a sudden. You know, you look at it and it's like, well, they were really good with Stofall earlier and they don't have him anymore. And now you look at this pitching staff and it's full of freshmen pitching important spots, and B, like, it's without its ace. And it's not like this was a team that had a real number two to begin with. It's not like, oh, well, we took off the first half of the 1-2 punch, but we still have a good two. Like, it wasn't that kind of pitching staff to begin with. So they are going to have their work cut out for them. I just like the way that they're playing right now. And you can say that, like, Oral Roberts is the hottest team in the country, that they haven't lost since April. And, like, that's true. But Oregon has really found something. And what they seem to have found is the right mix on the mound. Surprise, surprise, a Mark Wazakowski coach team has, like, found its stride offensively. Like, of course it has. They're just playing well overall. And I think being at home is important for them. And, you know, if you look at what Oral Roberts has done this year, it's incredibly impressive. Like, Jonah Cox has hit in every game he's played in, but one, has hit in like 42 straight games. They've got an impressive offense that they're going to throw at Oregon, and Oregon better have a lead, or better not be behind anyway, you know, late in the games, or else they're going to have to deal with Denton. And that's not a comfortable spot to be in. So they're definitely going to have to be ready. This is not a bad team. Like, it might say that they're a number four seed, but they didn't win 49 games by accident. I just, something about the way Oregon's playing right now, like, they went in and they really took it to some good teams in Nashville. And I just respect what they've been able to do over the last 2 weeks to sweep through the Pac-12 tournament and then sweep through that field, especially beating Vanderbilt and beating Hunter Owen relatively handily on Saturday. It was like, it's not like they hammered them or anything, but Oregon just was never, you know, they just, it felt like they were right there the whole game, and you know, they were the ones controlling it, not having to answer Vanderbilt. They were on the front foot, is I guess the best way to say it. And if they're able to maintain that, if they're able to stay on the front foot, I think that they have the talent advantage on Oral Roberts that will propel them through this weekend.
Yeah, regardless, there's an argument to be made that this is the most interesting, intriguing matchup, because these are two teams that are super unfamiliar with one another. And I think,
yes,
and I think to your point, Oregon has to the best that it can right now. They've figured it out on the mound and who to throw and where. You mentioned Grayson Grinsell, the freshman left-hander, and then Turner Spiljaric has been also really, really strong for them, as has Logan Mercado. And Grinsell's a guy that he could throw twice this weekend, whether it's 4-4, 5-3, however you want to slice it. He's a guy who can give you extended innings twice in a weekend, and then, you know, things can get weird in super regionals. You might use another guy twice, but they've got it going on. So it's a really fascinating matchup.
All right. So we're going to move on to the supers that start on Saturday, and we'll break those down here in a second. But first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, moving on to our second set of Super Regionals. Those starting on Saturday, and we are going to start where they start on Saturday, and that is with the number one Wake Forest Demon Deacons hosting Alabama. That's starts at noon in Winston-Salem. Wake Forest, like, look, it was that was as impressive as you could ask for a regional weekend. They just hammered George Mason and Maryland. Was the competition the best that anyone faced this weekend? No, absolutely not. But what Wake Forest did to Maryland was, first of all, like, very impressive, and Maryland is a good team. But then also, like, what do you want from them? Like, they got the draw that they got. They earned the draw. They earned an easier draw, and they took care of business. So they're going to come in feeling good at home. You know, they're ready for the next round. Alabama swept through its regional. They took care of BC in the finals. I don't want to say they didn't break a sweat, but I will say that I thought I was going to spend a lot more time, like, scoreboard watching or actual watching the Tuscaloosa regional, and I spent very little time watching it, because it was when Alabama was playing, like, they were handling things. And so I think this is a really fun matchup here this weekend at the couch.
Yeah, and last weekend in Tuscaloosa, it was a really entertaining regional, almost underratedly so. I think it was easy for it to get overlooked because it wasn't maybe the sexiest grouping of teams. But as you said, it wasn't the opposite of Wake did with its 3-0 demolition, but it was a really hard-fought, hard-earned 3-0 record for the Crimson Tide. And on Friday, when we were kind of going through the tournament last week on the podcast, we mentioned Nichols and right-hander Jacob Mayers is one to watch, and he didn't disappoint. 5 2/3, 8 Ks, 2 earned runs. He kept Nichols in the game for its entirety, and Nichols was actually up 3-2 heading into the bottom of the 7th. Bama was able to tie it on a Matt Gassetti missile down the left field line, and they had to beat the Colonels in walk-off fashion with a Jim Jarvis single. So that was far from easy. And then you look at the game against Troy. Alabama was on its heels heading into the 9th. They were down 8-7, and they had runners on 2nd and 3rd with 2 outs for Tommy Seidel, who looked to ground a routine ground ball to the shortstop. But as its defense has been Troy's Achilles heel all season, and it really, really bit him in Tuscaloosa as the shortstop. He sailed the throw wide of the first base bag, 2-run score. Bama hangs another 2 for insurance, and then they kind of coasted to an 8-0 win over BC in the regional final. And then with Wake, I'm not really sure what else there is to say about it. It was a 48-7 demolition of George Mason twice in Maryland. I think that I wasn't expecting anything less than a 3-0 weekend from Wake. I did have the Northeastern Maryland winner. I had that game circled as one that would probably be close for its entirety. I was proven wrong. And then just for fun on Sunday, Wake piggybacked Josh Hartle with Sean Sullivan, and the two combined for 16 Ks over, I think, 7 2/3 innings. So that was about as impressive a showing as you can have, regardless of your seating. And I think that Alabama is a really good team. They're your Omaha sleeper, so I want to be respectful of that. As I'm going to have to hop on the bandwagon now because my Omaha sleeper got bounced. But I think that the Deacs are going to, again, take care of business and punch their ticket to the College World Series.
Look, I'm going to ride Alabama here.
You have to. You have to.
So first of all, I have to, right? Like, we've gotten this far. And I've made a lot less of the fact that my Omaha sleeper this year is good. Like, if you've been listening to this podcast for a couple years now, you know that I picked Notre Dame in 2021, and I made a lot out of that. Like, this year, I just to let the whole Tide thing kind of just slide. Like, some of that's because of kind of like what their season has been, and like take that in its totality, both that, like, for a while they didn't look all that great, and then the circumstances, and then like this last month has just been so unbelievable. Like I just don't even know where to start. Like the team that I picked as my Omaha sleeper, I feel like has changed so much, like three different times throughout the year, that it's like, well, I don't even know if the reasons that I picked them were like have anything to do with what they're doing today. So that's one reason why I have to stick with it, though, is they are my Omaha sleeper. If you pick up the college preview issue, there it is in print. But the other thing is that, look, the number one overall seed has lost three straight super regionals. And each time you would have been like, well, what do you mean they're going to lose? Like UCLA is going to lose to Michigan in 2019? Like people have forgotten that team, I think both because it was pre-pandemic and like nobody remembers anything. And also because it was a Pac-12 team, so they didn't have an intense level of familiarity with that UCLA team as the number one team in the country. But like that team was really, really good. And then in 2021, Arkansas gets beat by NC State. Nobody saw that coming. And then a year ago, Tennessee gets taken down by Notre Dame. And while, you know, I certainly said some things about how I thought Notre Dame could win that regional or that super regional, like still, I don't think like the world did not expect Tennessee to lose. So right now, Wake looks unbeatable, right? Like they've got the best pitching staff in the country. They've got a dangerous offense. They've got the home field advantage this weekend. They've got all of these things going for them. And like Alabama's not going to care about any of that. Like the way Alabama's playing, the way the looseness with which they have played for going on a month now, the way that they can pitch, like they're going to match up. You know, I'll ride with the tide. And, you know, again, like rationally, maybe if you look at this, like, how am I supposed to defend that? Like, you know, I can't give you X's and O's reasons necessarily, but like, I just think the way that Alabama is going to approach this mentally, I like. And at some point, Wake is going to feel pressure. They didn't feel it last weekend. I'm not surprised they didn't feel it last weekend, but they're going to feel pressure this weekend. And this Wake Forest team just hasn't had to deal with that throughout the season. And so we don't really know how they're going to respond. And I think that that is part of what happened to UCLA, to Arkansas, and to Tennessee, is that players and or coaches felt pressure that they were not used to, and they did not respond in a in the best way, and they ended up taking stunning season-ending losses as a result.
And in looking at this and trying to think of, okay, how can Bama do this? I think that game one is a must-win, or as close to a must-win as you can have in a non-elimination format or non-single game elimination format. I think if you can get, and it's a big, big ask, in both pitching at the couch and against the caliber lineup that Wake is going to trot out there, it's a big ask for him. But if you can get 6 to 7 innings of 2 to 3 run baseball from Luke Holman, you're going to be in that game in the late innings. And if you're in that game, you're going to believe that you can do it. And if you've got, you know, you've got Seidel and Andrew Pinckney, Drew Williamson, Colby Shelton as 22 jacks, they can swing it as well. And all it takes is 1 or 2 big swings. You come out with a 4-3 win, 5-3, whatever low scoring margin you want to come up with. And that might be just enough for the Tide to get it done. And then you've got a game one win under your belt, and Wake is suddenly on the rope. So while I'm going to ride with the Deeks here, I think that it's well within reach that Bama does pull off this upset, because as you mentioned, just with everything that's gone on within that program, there isn't an environment or test or adversity that's going to phase them at this point. You know, they're not going to blink walking into Winston-Salem. So I think on Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon at noon, it's going to be a really, really good baseball game.
The Michigan team and the Notre Dame team that won those supers, they both won game one. NC State took a different route. They lost 21-2. They punted on that game at some point and saved all of their relievers. So there are two routes that the teams have taken lately. But yeah, I do think, Peter, you're right, that winning game one is really significant, because it puts that pressure on them right away. like they feel pressure on that Saturday, but then they have to sleep on that pressure going into Sunday. And while both UCLA and Tennessee responded and won game two, but like now your entire weekend is pressure and you haven't felt that pressure all year long, like that's a big deal, I think. And so yeah, just go beat Rhett Lowder. That's all you got to do.
Yeah, no big deal. And then you gotta beat Rhett Lowder, and then you gotta beat one of Sean Sullivan and Hartle. So should be a cakewalk in Winston-Salem.
Yeah. So I also, though, am interested to see how Wake sets up the pitching. They pitched off with Keener on the Friday. So that means Lowder's on normal rest going into Saturday. And then I assume that it would be Hader in game two. And then they would probably just figure out where they are from there for a game three, whether, you know, they needed Keener extended in one of those first two games or whether Sullivan makes more sense. But great problems to have, obviously, and that's been the case all year at Wake Forest.
Just an embarrassment of riches.
Moving on, we got both of these next two start at 3, but we're going to head to Hattiesburg. That's a controversial thing that we're headed to Hattiesburg and not Knoxville, but it's Tennessee at Southern Miss. Tennessee swept through that Clemson regional. We talked about their magnificent win against Clemson on Saturday. They finished it off with a win against Charlotte to complete the regional. Tennessee is in Supers for the third straight year. Southern Miss is back in Supers for the second straight year, having done it the hard way. They lost their opener to the Auburn regional. They lost to Samford, and then they won four straight. They knocked out Auburn, and then they got revenge on Samford, and then they beat Penn twice, denying us another Cinderella team. Instead, we get Southern Miss trying to get to Omaha in Scott Barry's final season. This is happening in Hattiesburg because the selection committee had to make a decision. Both of these teams were two seeds. If you ask the people in Knoxville, it seems like they think they should host because Hattiesburg doesn't have an Applebee's. I don't know. Twitter's a strange place. It's a very strange place. I think both of these teams had a case to host, a very strong case. I kind of would have leaned Tennessee because they swept through that regional in Clemson, and I think it was close a week ago. I think Southern Miss hosting is an indication that maybe it wasn't as close a week ago as we thought, that maybe Southern Miss was pretty close to the top 16 as it was. In any case, Pete Taylor Park is where this one is going to be this weekend, and it is going to be jumping, I am sure.
One, it's going to be bananas. I can't even imagine what it's going to be like down there. It's some of the two of the best fan bases in college baseball. And I'm really, really looking forward to this one because you've got Southern Miss and Scott Barry's last season. You have the storyline there, playing for something a whole lot bigger than just a, not just, but then a berth to the College World Series. And then you have Tennessee, who last year shockingly lost to Notre Dame, had their historic season end prematurely, and they're coming into Hattiesburg with a big time chip on its shoulder. And you know, they're going to have their work cut out for them on Saturday when they get Tanner Hall, who he threw 11 innings in 4 days. I know that Twitter was like that gif of, I think, Donald Glover, like coming back with the pizza box to like the house on fire. I think that was basically a metaphor for what Twitter was when they saw that Tanner Hall was announced as the starter for the decisive game 7 of the Auburn regional. But nonetheless, Tanner Hall is going to give Tennessee as good a look at an opposing pitcher as it's seen all year. But man, I think that between the kind of trying to avenge last year, the emotional regional win in Clemson headlined by that 14 inning marathon, and then just the personnel that they have, particularly offensively. Southern Miss does have Dustin Dickerson, Matthew Etzel, Slade Wilkes. It's an impressive bunch. Captain Danny Lynch. It's a really impressive bunch. It's a gritty group. And then you have Tanner Hall, who's as good as any starting pitcher in the country. I lean Tennessee here in a really, really good three-game series that's probably the most exciting and closest of any super regional we get this weekend. I think you look at the depth of that starting rotation with Andrew Lindsay and Dolander and Drew Beam, and then you can use Chase Burns in a myriad of ways out of the bullpen. He's most effective. And then there are other bullpen arms with Sechrist and Combs, and Hollis Fanning even has given you quality innings. So I think that in the end, offensively, the Vols are just going to have a couple of more big hits than the Golden Eagles to eke out a super regional victory.
Yeah, maybe this is coming from a place of I just saw Tennessee play the game of the year and look really good all weekend. But yeah, give me the Vols. I think that the Southern Miss team is good. I just think that Tennessee is not quite playing as well as we thought maybe they would when we ranked them number two in the preseason. But they're close, and they're closer to that than they've been at any time this year. And that team is scary. The pitching that you just ran through, like, I don't need to remind anyone, I don't think, but Southern Miss didn't score a run in Super Regionals last year against Ole Miss, and this Tennessee pitching staff is better than Ole Miss's was a year ago. And this Southern Miss lineup is mostly the same. So, you know, like, is that unfair to Southern Miss to bring that up? Maybe. It's a different year. They have that experience now, whatever. But the way Tennessee can pitch, the fact that this Southern Miss team is not, like, it's not strength on strength. This is not one of those. This is going to be a pitching regional. And as good as Southern Miss is on the mound, I think I like Tennessee more. I know I like Tennessee more. Like, the amount of power arms they're going to run out there is crazy. One thing to watch is that what they did with Tanner Hall this year, they did last year as well, and then they held Tanner Hall for game two. That, we'll see if they do that again this year. I would expect that's the plan, just given how much he pitched last weekend and the short rest of it all. However, a year ago, they did have Hurston Waldrop to turn to for game one. They don't have a pitcher that's like Hurston Waldrop to turn to this year in a game one, so I expect that Hall will go in game two, but that is something to watch here as Southern Miss has to make pitching decisions this weekend.
And with Hall going on in game two potentially, and while they don't have Waldrop, what I think would be a likely scenario and one that would give the Golden Eagles the best chance to win is if they go Armistead maybe to start, and Justin Storm perhaps piggybacking him.
Justin Storm was phenomenal against Penn.
He was lights out in his appearance against Penn in that 11-2 win, which was way, way closer than the final score indicates.
Yeah, they scored 9 runs in the last 2 innings or something.
Right. It was 3-2 in the ninth, and then they exploded for 8, but he went 5 2/3 shutout, 10 Ks, gave up 1 hit. So if I'd probably go Armistead if you can get 4 out of him, and then you go Storm and then maybe Sively to close it out if Storm can't go 5 again. But they don't have Waldrop, but they do have the personnel that when they've got their best stuff, they can go toe-to-toe with anyone in the country. But as you mentioned, the issue for them is it kind of projects to be how are they gonna hit with the Vols potentially.
Yeah, how do you score enough runs to beat Tennessee? Because this Tennessee offense is not last year's Tennessee offense, but like you got to find a way to score a few runs to beat them. And, you know, this is, again, it's just not what Southern Miss does best. It's not offense. So, you know, they had a pretty nice weekend offensively at Auburn. Can they carry that over now is going to be the question. And that's going to be the question no matter who Tennessee was facing this weekend. That was going to be the question. Can they score enough to beat them? Because runs are hard to come by against that Tennessee pitching staff right now. Now, the one thing, maybe not the one thing, but one of the things that Southern Miss is going to look at and be like, well, okay, I feel confident because of X. It's that Tennessee has not played well on the road. The last few weeks, though, Tennessee hasn't been home at all. You know, they won a series at South Carolina. They went 0-1 in Hoover, but then they go to Clemson and win 3 games away from Lindsey Nelson. So I feel like some of that's getting cleaned up, but this is a true road game, a true road series. And it's a true road test because, you know, Hattiesburg is a difficult place to play. Those fans are going to be ready for it. You know, Ole Miss passed that test just fine a year ago, but, you know, it's not, this is a tough environment that the Vols are going to walk into. Moving on to this other one that starts at 3 o'clock on Saturday, another tough road environment as Kentucky is headed to LSU. This is a dead rematch. That was even played in the same place, like at least. So this is just like the Duke UVA situation. Kentucky went to the box earlier this year and lost a series. But Kentucky comes in here. They won the Lexington Regional. They bounce back after losing the winner's bracket to Indiana on Saturday night to come back and win three straight must-win games. They beat Indiana in the final to win their second regional ever in program history, first since 2017. LSU, meanwhile, rolled through the Baton Rouge Regional. They beat Oregon State twice. The first game was really close. They got the go-ahead run in the eighth inning, finally, for good. And then the final was a little bit more LSU than Oregon State, but a good regional nonetheless for the Tigers. One X factor, though, is that on Monday, right after LSU finished beating Oregon State to win the regional, it was came out that Wes Johnson is going to be the next head coach at Georgia. He's staying with LSU through the end of the postseason, but that is that's probably something they don't love that they have to deal with this week. You know, I don't think that'll actually make much of a difference, but it is it's a thing. And it was strange timing to say the least.
Yeah, and no pun intended here. That's a pretty big curveball for the Tigers. But as you mentioned, I don't think it's going to really affect any prep or the games themselves this weekend. But still, I mean, that's a really big deal for Coach Wes Johnson, and kudos to him for landing the Georgia head coaching job. But I think that while Kentucky, they do play a really unique style in today's day and age. They'll really push the pace. They'll speed the game up. They stormed through the loser's bracket with three straight wins. I lean Tennessee here. I think that it's going to be similar to the season they play, the series rather, that they played in mid-April with LSU taking two of three. I don't think that by any means the Tigers are going to roll. I just think with it being at the box, the storybook season that they've put together, more or less living up to their sky-high expectations in the preseason, I think that they, especially offensively, and to their credit, the pitching did look pretty good this weekend, I thought. It wasn't as offensive a regional as I had thought. And then I think being able to more than likely go up 1-0 with Skeens on the mound, who Kentucky actually hit pretty well against Skeens, but I think being able to trot out Paul Skeens to set the tone is going to be really tough to potentially overcome if you're the Wildcats. But again, they won their second regional ever. Mason Moore, 10 shutout innings across the weekend. Offense looked good. They had timely hitting all weekend, and they were, on both sides of the baseball, they were really, really good. So uphill battle for the Cats. I lean LSU in three here.
Yeah, I give me the Tigers. You know, they certainly have the advantage being at home and having Paul Skeens and having already beaten Kentucky. The series in Baton Rouge was relatively tight. So, you know, Kentucky's going to come in feeling pretty confident that they can do this. Like, they know how close they played LSU, you know, and they know, they probably feel like they can, you know, correct whatever mistakes they made and come away with a different result this time around. You know, LSU at home is just so hard. And the fact that you have to deal with Paul Skeens out of the chute, and, you know, a lot got made out of how many pitches Paul Skeens got through last Friday. But A, it wasn't that many. Ultimately, like, it was 124 on like 8 or 9 days of rest. I think it was 8 days of rest, and he had thrown 70 pitches the week before. Like, it's fine. And he has an extra day of rest anyway here. So, like, it's fully rested Paul Skeens. Good luck dealing with that for anybody. So I think you feel really good to start with that. And then I know that LSU is going to feel like they can find, you know, one more win. They had to deal with some rain last weekend, throughout the weekend, really. You know, their game on Saturday got pushed to Sunday, and which is why they then had to play on Monday. Even within that, the second game, you know, Ty Floyd's start got interrupted, but he was pitching pretty well before then. And, you know, I think they found out some things about their pitching staff over the last 3 weeks at Georgia, when Thatcher Hurd turned in a really nice relief outing at the SEC tournament. And then again here last weekend, and Thatcher Hurd was really good in what became a piggyback of Ty Floyd because of the rain. And I just think they're set up in a much better spot pitching wise than they were a month ago or when they played Kentucky the first time. You know, so that offense, Paul Skeens, the way the pitching staff seems to have worked through some things, you know, I like LSU this weekend for sure.
Yeah, and the pitching is still a work in progress and probably LSU's one Achilles heel. But as you mentioned, not only they have Skeens, you've got Ty Floyd, and then Thatcher Hurd has been much improved over the last however long. And then you have Riley Cooper as well, who can give you quality innings. Same with Griffin Herring, who has shown flashes. So,
and they didn't even throw Coleman last weekend. And that was Jay Johnson said they're holding him out in case they needed to play a fourth game on the weekend. So they also have him and he's fully rested.
Right. Not only with him. And then you've got Gavin Guidry, who's been really reliable in a late inning role. And so it's kind of, it took a little while, but for the Tigers, granted they had their fair share of injuries, but their new look pitching staff is coming together at, I think, the perfect time.
Absolutely. All right. So the last one, the last super regional to talk about here is out west. And this might be the best matchup of the bunch, or the sexiest matchup of the bunch. It starts at 6 on Saturday. It's Texas at Stanford. Texas swept through the Coral Gables regional, which I had identified as a upset watch regional. And Texas showed why, as they knock off Miami twice to move on. Stanford took the hard route, as they are wont to do, but they got through the losers bracket in their own regional. This is the third time in 4 years that Stanford has had to do it that way. They just don't care. They nothing fazes them, and they beat A&M in the regional final to advance and deny the world a Texas versus Texas A&M super regional, which honestly we're probably, I don't want to say we're better off. It would have been a lot of fun, but it also would have been very combustible. So maybe we are better off with Texas going to Stanford. I think this is awesome. You know, two great college baseball programs going at it. Texas has a great 1-2 punch of Lucas Gordon and LeBaron Johnson, who has turned into one of the best pitchers in the country in the second half, going up against an incredible lineup that Stanford is going to be throwing out there against the Horns. So I think this is a really fun matchup at Sunken.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matchup between two of the best college baseball programs around. As you mentioned, with Stanford, in typical Stanford fashion, they dropped a regional game and made it hard on themselves to advance the Supers, but they did just that. They beat Fullerton in a tight one before rather soundly beating A&M twice. And in that 13-5 game, it was, I don't want to say closer than the final score indicated, but similar to Southern Miss scoring 8 in the ninth to make that a lopsided margin. Stanford scored 7 in the seventh in that 13-5 game to win that one. Tommy Troy hit a grand slam that I legitimately don't know if it's landed yet, but they get another super regional in Palo Alto. They're playing great baseball, and you know, Texas, I think I know where you might lean in this one, but the Longhorns, one, they're fresh off a sweep in Coral Gables. They beat Miami twice. They did so, I don't want to say maybe in convincing fashion, but LeBaron Johnson Jr. stymied the Hurricanes all evening, and he's, as far as the draft goes, one of the biggest risers, I think, of the postseason and the last few weeks. It's a veteran-clad bunch. It is a really gritty bunch. Dylan Campbell, I think his hitting streak is at 38 games or 37 games.
I think it's 30.
And then, regardless, super impressive. And then you had mentioned Peyton Powell. We had touched on him, I think, a little bit earlier on in the season as kind of your unsung hero, maybe Murphy Staley type of guy in that lineup that they seem to have every year. And he's, the stat lines are pretty similar. It's a little bit less production, but 340 with 15 doubles and 10 home runs. They play really good baseball on either side. And as you mentioned, that Lucas Gordon, LeBaron Johnson 1-2 punch is, it's going to be a difficult one, not only for Stanford to handle, but any team in the country. And then in the bullpen, they've also thrown the ball well with guys like Heston Toll and Charlie Hurley contributing quality innings as well. So this Oral Roberts at Oregon and then Stanford, Texas. And there's really reason to be excited about all eight of these matchups, but watching Stanford and Texas go at it for two, maybe three games for the next few nights on starting on Friday, is that's going to be tough to top, because it is two excellent teams and two of the most historic college baseball programs out there. So there's not really much more you can ask for.
No, absolutely not. So which way do you think I'm leaning?
I think that you're going to lean Texas.
So I think that I would like to, but here's the thing. Stanford just did what it does every year, aka go through the losers bracket, and like they'll probably lose one of these first two games against Texas to force a game three, because that's what happens. But what happens is Stanford wins their home super regionals. And, you know, like, I like where Texas is at right now. They bounced back from, you know, a tough showing at the Big 12 tournament. You know, they played really well at Miami. They, you know, just a couple weeks ago swept West Virginia to win the Big 12 title. Like, I think that they're playing well right now, and Gordon and Johnson are a problem to deal with. The problem with that, though, is that if Stanford does win one of the first two games, like if Texas doesn't sweep this, I think Texas has to sweep, is what I'm trying to say here. I love Tanner Witt. I love Tanner Witt so much. But he wasn't great against Miami, and he's not going to go deep into the games at this point. So if they start him in game three, if there is a game three and Tanner Witt gets the start, Texas is really going to need a group effort. I don't like anybody needing a group effort against this Stanford offense. I think you have to have a very committed plan, and just the more arms you introduce into that plan, the more likely it is Stanford's going to crack one of them. And so if they can just piggyback Witt and Hurley, like maybe that would get it done. But if they need Hurley earlier in the weekend, I think it becomes a real issue. I just don't know if Texas is deep enough on the mound. Like their 1-2 is maybe as good as you'll find in the field, you know, obviously outside of Wake Forest. You know, just on performance, there are definitely pitchers with better stuff than Lucas Gordon out there. But on performance right now, like Gordon and Johnson match up with just about anyone. But the depth to the Texas pitching staff against an incredible Stanford offense on the road is what scares me.
Yeah, and you meant it's not Waldrop and Sproat in terms of stuff, but it's as good of a duo in terms of guys who know how to pitch and have feel for their arsenal. And I don't know if I said kind of what my thinking was for the series, but as you mentioned, Stanford just knows how to like, they're incredibly familiar playing these types of games and in these types of settings, and they just know how to win. And whether they lose game one or they lose game two to make it a potentially a 1-1 series, they're not going to be fazed in the slightest. And I just think no matter how it looks, they're going to figure out a way to get it done in the end. And I think that they have a big time weapon, both offensively and on the mound, with the Pac-12 pitcher and player of the year, respectively, in Quinn Matthews and Alberto Rios. And it doesn't stop with Rios and Matthews. You know, you've got Tommy Troy, who is hitting .410 with 17 home runs, leadoff man Eddie Park, and then superstar sophomore Braden Montgomery has also been great, as well as Malcolm Moore, who is arguably one of the best, if not the best, freshman hitters in the country, maybe just behind Ethan Petrie and Charlie Condon if you count red shirts. But I think that, one, the Cardinals' depth on the mound is they've got more than what the Longhorns have, and then that offense is just so difficult, if not impossible, to contain. And then with all of those factors, combining it with, you know, that this is a team that is here seemingly every year, and every year they come out on top, I think that the Cardinal are going to make their fourth straight trip to TD Ameritrade Field.
I guess if I am going to, like, say that I'm going on vibes as much as I am with Stanford as much as anything else, like, I do like the strength of their offense against the depth of Texas's pitching staff. But, like, it should be noted that David Pierce is an incredible postseason coach. Texas hasn't lost a game in regionals since 2017. They have won three straight regionals, three straight super regionals. You know, they've been to Omaha three of the last four seasons. And, you know, the one time they missed the entire tournament. You know, that 2017 season when he lost a regional at Long Beach State, like, that was his first team at Texas. Like, his guys know how to win. They went on the road last year. They won at ECU in incredibly difficult circumstances. But they found a way to dig out that regional, or that super regional rather. They just are coming off of winning a road regional, something Texas hadn't done since 2014. Now, I mean, granted, they don't play a ton of road regionals, but, like, they just won a road regional. They're not going to be phased by this stuff. So I it just adds to the layers in this matchup, I think. But I just can't get over Stanford's postseason history of just, like, we're going to make it as hard as we possibly can on ourselves in these first two rounds, but we're still going to win because we have that kind of offense and we have enough arms to make it happen.
Right. And my Stanford prediction is not I don't think it's going to be a 2-0 resounding sweep of the Longhorns, but somehow, some way, we're going to be sitting here at the end of the weekend talking about Stanford and the College World Series again.
We are in agreement on that, but I think that is going to be the best super regional. It's the series that going into this weekend has the most of my attention, I would say.
Absolutely. I'm in agreement there.
All right, so that is the eight supers. You know, we've got a great weekend of baseball to come. We had some news over the last week. I mentioned Wes Johnson getting hired by Georgia. Kerrick Jackson got hired by Missouri, becoming the first Black head baseball coach in SEC history. Some other coaching changes, the transfer portal's humming. Like, we've got all of this covered for you over at baseballamerica.com and on our Twitter feeds. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. I'm at Ted Cahill. So make sure you give us a follow there. Check everything out over at the website, and subscribe to the Baseball America podcast, wherever you get your podcast, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. You can find it there. Hit the subscribe button. We're going to continue podcasting through the postseason. We'll come out with one next week, probably on Thursday, but make sure you're subscribed so that, you know, it just pops right into your phone there, and you don't have to worry about when we record leading up to the College World Series. That CWS preview will just pop right into your feed. So hit the subscribe or the follow button, and we really appreciate everyone sticking with us through this very exciting postseason. So when we talk to you next time, we'll know the eight teams headed to Omaha. Peter and I will be getting ready to head to Omaha. So until then, enjoy the baseball. Thank you for listening. For Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.
Well- Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.